Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Urban agriculture allows a dialogue between the generations, which I think we've also been missing in North America for a very long time.
Author Jennifer Cockrell King digs into the history of growing food in cities, and she tells us about some of the innovative projects she's seeing in urban areas around the world. What does tobacco farming have to do with the increase in sweet potato production? Harvest tells us more. And then our shopping list for Daniel Orr's sauce recipes include tahini, turmeric, honey, vinegar, and lots of tofu. First, with Mark Chilla, a look at some food news.
What a week, Annie. Our reporters were working overtime to cover all the stories that popped up during President Donald Trump's first full week in office. Many in the agriculture industry were forced to regroup this week after President Trump formally backed out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. During a rancorous election campaign that saw both the Democratic and Republican presidential candidates vow to scrap the TPP, large farm groups were among just a handful of political organizations working to drum up support for the deal. Central to the farm groups' concern, China, which was not a part of the 12-country TPP. As the TPP falls apart, China is reportedly advancing in plans for a new 16-member trade deal that, if completed, would lower tariffs on goods from member countries, leaving U.S. farm exports at a disadvantage. U.S. farm exports were worth $130 billion in the 2016 fiscal year, according to USDA data. Canada, China, Mexico, the EU, and Japan were the top destinations for agricultural goods from the U.S. Then it was news that employees of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's main research arm, the Agricultural Research Service, had been ordered to stop publicizing their work. The very next day, following a public relations backlash, the division's chief administrator sent an email walking back the directive. ARS researchers study everything from waterway pollution to climate change and often work hand in hand with researchers at land-grant universities. The agency operates research stations, test fields, and laboratories scattered across the country, many of which are in rural areas. The impact of even a temporary order restricting communication remains to be seen. But there are fears both inside and outside of the USDA that the Trump administration plans to control research and communication at federal agencies in unprecedented ways. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, helps about 43 million people buy food. But the administrator currently in charge of SNAP is worried that assistance could soon be cut. For Harvest Public Media, Jason Parrott reports.
Kevin Concannon is the USDA's Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. He says a majority of the SNAP recipients hold jobs, but they don't make much money. Concannon says people outside of the program don't always believe that, instead insisting SNAP is fraught with fraud and misuse. And he says it's that message that is growing in Washington, D.C.
I'm frankly more worried about voices in Congress that would like to block grant the program, because I see that as just a way to weaken it, to make it less accessible to poor people across the country.
Concannon says simply providing grants to states or local governments does not guarantee the people most in need will get enough assistance. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jason Parrott.
U.S. prosecutors have launched a probe into reports that high-level Venezuelan officials received kickbacks and bribes for food contracts meant to relieve an ongoing hunger crisis. The Associated Press reported in December that while the country's military has managed a dwindling food supply, food ministers, generals, and other top brass have profited from graft and sales of products diverted to the black market. Venezuelans wait hours in line for dwindling supplies, and hunger has spurred massive street protests and waves of migrants fleeing into neighboring Colombia. In 2015, the Obama administration froze U.S. assets and blocked visas for officials accused of drug trafficking and other human rights violations. Those measures were extended this month, along with sanctions against six other countries, 1 week before the end of President Obama's term. And something a little more lighthearted to round out the news, a poultry producer in China found a new way to monitor its chickens with robots. China's third largest poultry producer uses 18 robot nannies to monitor their 3 million birds for signs of bird flu. The nannies are humanoid robots on wheels that roam the coops for 12 hours a day, recording bird temperature and movements. Sick birds are taken from the coops by human employees to protect other birds and to prevent contaminated eggs from reaching the market. China is the world's largest producer of eggs and the second largest producer of chicken. The industry generates over $100 billion a year. These stories are on our website. That's eartheats.org.
Oh, and you can also check out a video we posted that shows how drones are changing farming. Okay, Mark, see you next time.
Yep, see you then.
Drive past a field of corn or soybeans in the Midwest, and you can be almost sure that they're genetically engineered. That's been the case since the 90s. But now, GMO foods are moving from the field to your kitchen. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach explains.
I'm at home helping get some dinner started, and tonight we're having roasted potatoes and steak. And I was looking around the kitchen to see if we have anything here that's genetically modified. I know the potatoes aren't, and the steak isn't either, although the steer that gave us the steak probably did eat some genetically modified corn. Most of the things that you do find in your kitchen are at least a few steps removed from the GMO crops in your field. That's one thing that's about to change.
My name is Neil Carter, and I'm the president of Okanagan Specialty Fruits, and we're a company located in Summerland, British Columbia, that has developed the non-browning Arctic apple.
The Arctic apple is the first genetically engineered apple. Its genes are altered so when you cut it or take a bite, it doesn't brown. The first version of the apple, the Arctic Golden Delicious, is headed for test markets in the Midwest in February. Carter wouldn't say exactly where, but he says it's about making apples as convenient as baby carrots.
I can cut this up in my kid's lunchbox and I'll slice up the apple and it doesn't go brown and they'll actually eat it.
It's one of the first GMO foods marketed at consumers, not farmers, and that's a sign of how the science of genetic engineering is evolving. The old way was focused on big commodity crops, corn, soybeans, cotton. It was aimed at making them resistant to pesticides or insects by adding new DNA into the plants. Sally McKenzie is a plant geneticist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
We were taking DNA sequences from another often non-plant species, and moving it into plants. And the next generation of technologies, those being implemented now, including the new apple, we're not introducing foreign DNA any longer.
The new way works within a plant's own genome. For instance, the Arctic apple uses a technology called RNA interference, sometimes called gene silencing. There's a gene in the apple that produces an enzyme that makes it turn brown. But if you add an extra strand of RNA, that gene is effectively switched off or silenced.
We're basically down-regulating a gene that's already within that apple. So I see that as entirely different, and I think it's important for the average consumer to recognize that technologies have moved on.
That's important because it makes biotech plant breeding cheaper and more precise, and less expensive when it comes to federal regulations. McKenzie says that changes the business side of biotech. She says huge companies like Monsanto have dominated the industry because of the cost of regulations. Old technology focused on big commodities, in part because it's a sure way to recoup that investment. But engineered plants that don't introduce new genes also don't face the same regulatory hurdles.
So you're going to see more and more, I think, traits coming out that are really consumer-friendly, designed to respond to consumer demand and for smaller markets, you know, for the apple market, which isn't nearly as huge as, let's say, the corn market.
Corn will still get plenty of attention, but more companies may shift their focus from the field to your fridge. The Arctic apple will be one of the first GMOs to reach the produce aisle directly, not as an ingredient. But it's not the only one. A virus-resistant papaya is already on the shelf, so is a bruise-resistant russet potato. And the fruit company Del Monte has approval for a pink pineapple, engineered to carry more of the antioxidant lycopene. Joan Driggs is editorial director of Progressive Grocer, which covers the grocery business. Her advice for stores is to be upfront that these foods are genetically engineered.
Transparency is what everything is about. Any retailer or manufacturer has to be transparent with their customer.
The big question for the biotech industry is, once consumers know how these apples were created, whether they'll care. The Arctic Apples test run will last through March. The company expects a wider commercial release this fall. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
More stories like this one collected at harvestpublicmedia.org. We're going into the kitchen straight away today with Chef Daniel Orr. He's presenting two final sauces for January. If you've been keeping track this month, we've made a beet vinaigrette, a roasted garlic aioli, and a tofu roux. Get another couple blocks of tofu ready for today's recipes. The idea here is to demonstrate how you can harness, well, I guess the blandness of tofu. It'll taste basically like whatever you put with it.
All right.
So first, a vegan sour cream.
And you can use this, you know, for Super Bowl. You could do nachos with this. You could do quesadillas. You could do anything you use sour cream, you can use this on. And the added benefit is that you get very little fat and you get a lot of extra protein. So it's a good way to put extra protein into your diet. So what we're done here, we've got a nice high-powered blender and we're going to put some tofu in it. Now this is firm tofu that we're adding first. And that's going to be, you know, a little dry and crumbly. And that's going to give us a little body. And what I've done is, before we did this, I wrapped it in some paper towel and got a lot of the excess moisture out of it. Then we're going to add a second kind of tofu, which is called silken tofu. And that's much more soft and tender. And then we're going to add the flavorings. And what we've got is a little bit of salt and a little bit of olive oil. We've got some honey, which is going to kind of bring out that sweet dairy flavor that you think of when you get sour cream. And you could use any of your favorite hot sauces, you know, whether it's Tabasco or your homemade hot sauce. We're going to use some of the vinegar from our pickled peppers that we did. And in the pickled peppers, we have some cinnamon and some ginger and some habaneros. So just going to put a couple tablespoons of that in. That also is going to give us some of the acidity that you think of when you think of sour cream. This is a great base for dips, too. You could use this as the base and throw in some roasted red peppers. You could add some curry to it and make a curry dip. Some wasabi and make a wasabi mayonnaise out of this. So there are a lot of different ways you can use this. Okay, and then we just put the blender on until everything's nice and combined.
All right, same thing for this recipe with firm and silken tofu. And then tahini, which, if you've never used it before, is sesame seed paste. You can buy it in a jar from the store, or it's pretty simple to make it yourself. We'll post a how-to on Earth Eats Twitter page.
And now we're going to start adding our flavors. So we're going to add a couple cloves. Let's say, let's make it nice and garlicky. 4 cloves of garlic. I'm just going to slice these right into the blender bowl. Okay, another great flavor to add to this. Ginger. We want this to be kind of a zippy kind of dip. We're going to add next a little bit of tahini. You know, tahini always has that oil floating on the top of it. I'm going to dip down into that, the kind of peanut buttery goo from the bottom. And then we're going to add some cumin, 1/2 teaspoon of turmeric, which will give it a nice color. We're going to add about 1 teaspoon of chili powder. And we added that fresh garlic, but I'm also going to add just a little bit of granulated garlic because it has a kind of a roasted garlic flavor. If you smell that, it smells different than fresh garlic. And I like that kind of roasted flavor, so I use a little bit of both in there. Okay, we're going to add about 1/4 cup of olive oil, which is going to give you that richness and that mouthfeel. A little bit of salt. And a touch of lemon juice. All right, we'll put the lid on and give it a whirl. You really taste that tahini. You don't get any kind of tofu feel at all. I think it's really delicious.
Now that you have some tahini, you'll need other recipes in which to put the sesame seed paste. We posted a no-bake pie that features tahini and dark chocolate at eartheats.org. Either of these sauces would be great on a baked sweet potato. Coming up, Americans are eating almost twice as many sweet potatoes as we did 17 years ago. Harvest Public Media tries to understand what's up with our obsession with the orange tuber. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. This is Earth Eats. Thanks for tuning in. Americans are eating more sweet potatoes today than we have for a long time, and farmers are churning out numbers that we haven't seen in 70 years. We sent Christopher Husted to find out why.
To understand the rebirth of the nation's love for sweet potatoes, we should first go back to the time when potatoes were in high demand.
In a world where millions are starving, America has become the breadbasket as well as the arsenal of democracy. Our farmlands and ranges must produce more food than ever before to supply our own needs and to help our fighting allies.
A lot of things were hard to get during World War II, and potatoes were easier to raise than some of the other vegetables.
That's my grandmother, Joyce Heisey. She grew up outside of Philadelphia. Her grandfather farmed potatoes and their orange sister tuber, sweet potatoes.
And then some things were rationed, so you had to do with what the best you could.
Planting 20% more potatoes this year than last, farmers in one American state seek to beat their 1942 crop record.
Regular potatoes and sweet potatoes were a staple in American victory gardens and on dining tables. Why? They were cheap and really easy to grow. And back then, we didn't have sweets like we do now. So sweet potatoes satisfied that sweet tooth at a discount for Americans strapped for sugar and cash. Grandma Joyce says there were dozens of ways she and her friends cooked with sweet potatoes.
Sometimes baked sweet potatoes.
Mashed sweet potatoes.
Put some butter and salt and pepper in it.
Your grandfather, he'd like a casserole.
Almost like what they used to call a pot pie.
Bake that.
Brown sugar on
marshmallows
it.
On it.
I still like sweet potatoes.
By the end of the war, farmers here were growing more than 3 billion pounds of sweet potatoes. But when soldiers returned home, people went back to work and the economy hummed.
It became cheaper to buy russet potatoes than, you know, to grow your own sweet potatoes.
April McGregor grew up on a sweet potato farm in Mississippi and wrote about the history of the root vegetable in her book called, well, Sweet Potatoes.
We really had this sort of movement away from farming families, small farming families in the U.S., into working people, more industrialized jobs that mean people purchasing more of their food instead of growing it.
Industrialization of farming and the rise of processed foods left sweet potatoes in the dust. U.S. production dropped by 1 billion pounds right after the war, and it bottomed out in 1980. Fast forward to the 2000s.
But I've saved my best tip for last. This is actually my personal favorite meal. I have it a lot. It's the sweet potato.
The TV host Dr. Oz was one of many sweet potato converts. For anyone cutting bad carbs or going paleo, the sweet, hearty sweet potato was a godsend.
All these diets that are, you know, have tons and tons of followers are really touting sweet potatoes as being this superfood.
As Americans were encouraged to cut sugar intake and eat more fiber and antioxidants, the sweet potato, chock full of vitamins, began to show up on plates again, as well as in grocery stores and fast food joints. Top chefs incorporated them as a quintessential Southern food. In 2000, Americans ate about 4 pounds of sweet potatoes per person. Today, it's nearly double that. McGregor says farmers noticed, especially tobacco farmers.
Right now, the largest producer of sweet potatoes is North Carolina. Those are tobacco farmers that have switched to sweet potatoes because it's a relatively good cash crop to replace tobacco.
There's one more piece to the puzzle. David Trinklein is an associate professor of plant sciences at the University of Missouri.
In the last 10 years, there has been a tremendous increase percentage-wise of sweet potato exports, a lot of them going to Europe.
Northern Europe, to be specific, where it's too cool to grow sweet potatoes. So, hungry Europeans? Check. Decline of tobacco? Check. Health-conscious Americans and chefs into local food? Check, check. Add up all of these factors, and U.S. farmers produced 3.1 billion pounds of sweet potatoes in 2015, a number the nation hadn't hit since, well, you know when.
American farmers are working overtime to produce the food to win the war.
Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Reporters like Chris are stationed all over the Midwest and Rocky Mountains. Their stories are compiled at harvestpublicmedia.org. A study from 2014 on urban agriculture found that about 1.1 billion acres of cropland around the world is in or within about 12 miles of cities. Jennifer Cockrell King anticipates that number to only go up. She says if your city has gardens or farms in it, you've probably noticed.
Once you start allowing space to grow food in cities, it changes the texture of the city.
She is the author of Food and the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution.
And I think people are now starting to realize that it's not just a place where we put condos up so that we can live, jump in our car, drive to the office, drive back in the evening, watch TV, go to sleep.
Her book is published in English, Korean, and Japanese, which is appropriate because she's been around the world taking notes on how city dwellers are growing food. What she's seeing is a movement in its infancy. And just wait, we'll see more and more gardens infiltrating the fabric of our cities.
And we almost won't even notice it quite as much. I think the reason it's so noticeable right now is because for so long it was so absent from our cities. So I think as it becomes more integrated, it'll just be a matter of course that we'll have apartments and houses and schools and roads and community gardens or urban farms.
Urban gardening may seem like a new trend, but as she discovered, people have been growing food in cities for a long, long time. Her research into the history of the movement started back in the 1920s through the 40s with Victory Gardens. Americans were encouraged to grow food at home as a way to feel connected to the war effort and ease pressure on the country's food supply. And then King kept digging.
Going further back, Paris was a huge innovator of urban agriculture just in the medieval times up into the 18th century and just before the Industrial Revolution. The farmers there were putting together the techniques that we now call French intensive agriculture or potager gardening or whatever you want to call it.
Most of us call it raised bed gardening. Look at most urban farming operations and you'll see these wooden boxes. She discovered that over the years and across the world, people have adapted urban agriculture to fit whatever the community's needs are. Take Ghana, she says. They're using recycled gray water to grow food. In Cuba, she noticed their urban farms are organic, not because of some ideology, but because they had no choice.
For so long, they were very food insecure, and they didn't have the chemical inputs for what we call conventional agriculture. So they had to grow a lot of food organically in cities where they didn't have to refrigerate it. They didn't have to transport it to the, you know, the consumers.
Working her way around the world, she recently spoke at an urban ag convention in South Korea. Seoul is the second largest metropolitan area in the world with almost 26 million people.
Korea obviously had to recover from the Korean War in the 50s and had a very low GDP and was very poor for a very long time. It's only really been in the last 20 some years that they have roared onto the world stage to have a standard of living that they have now. So growing food at home was out of necessity, and pickling and cooking and all these skills And they're able to transmit them to their grandchildren, really. And I think that's what I find fascinating is it's urban agriculture allows a dialogue between the generations, which I think we've also been missing in North America for a very long time.
Perhaps so, but she is seeing hope in a project that's popping up in her town of Edmonton, Alberta. Spin farming is providing farming opportunities for young, new farmers who might not be able to afford to buy land of their own.
Which stands for small plot intensive farming. It's a really clever way of putting together little patches of front yards and backyards in a community for free for an urban farmer who wants to work that land and grow crops on it. And they essentially can canvass their neighbors for plots of land that they get rent free. And all they do in return for looking after the land and working the land is give some veggies back to the landowner, which is great. So I would think that's a pretty good deal.
No land, no problem. King says the simple act of growing tomatoes in a pot on your balcony does make a difference. And it's not nearly as labor-intensive as you might think. Nature pretty much takes care of itself. Something else we can learn from nature, she says, is that we can create so much abundance with a small amount of effort.
There's always this idea that how are we going to feed the world of 9 billion people? We have to increase our output. I think we need to put on a different set of glasses and look around and see the abundance that we have already around us.
And then, of course, there's the perk of creating community. King has more conversations with her neighbors when she's working in her garden than at any other time.
You just don't talk to your neighbors anymore. You just don't have random conversations. And we seem to be comfortable talking with people around food. And so that's one of the huge benefits is it can actually create a community and a cohesive community because it gets people out of their condos and their houses and cars and into the streets where we actually need to be to create better cities, happier cities, more supportive cities, safer cities.
Jennifer Cockrell King is the author of Food in the City, Urban Agriculture, and the New Food Revolution. You can read it in English, Korean, or Japanese. We've posted pictures of some of the urban gardens she's visited around the world. Gorgeous pictures at eartheats.org. Special thanks to Megan Betts for help with today's show. Shoutouts also to Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Indiana University's Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Oh, hey, subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done that yet, then you can listen on your own time. Alrighty, thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.